Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Pesky deer dining on your ornamentals? Confounded about composting? Unsure about this winter's unseasonably warm weather and what it means for your spring garden? The fabulous Mike McGrath, host of WHYY's hit gardening show You Bet Your Garden, joins us to share his knowledge on everything gardening. Mike McGrath launched his radio program in 1998. He was editor-in-chief of Organic Gardening Magazine from 1991 to 1997. And is the author of numerous books, including The Kitchen Garden Box and Mike McGrath's Book of Compost, which you can't keep on the shelves. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's actually a very interesting story, the path that led you that led you to the studios of WHYY. I think that you never imagined yourself to become an organic gardener, but were more inclined to become a scientist or a comic book writer.
I had gone to college for radio, TV, film. Oddly enough, I went to college on a National Merit Scholarship for science. But, you know, they took it back when they found out I wasn't taking any science classes. I loved the idea of going to school for communications, and I was actually very good at science, and I was a health writer for like 20 years. But I didn't want to study it. There was math.
You actually sort of became a health writer. A medical writer,
yeah,
because of a story you wrote for the Philadelphia Inquirer about a
car accident
that
where
you
I
were in.
Should have died. Yes,
yeah.
Yeah. I was writing at the time for Marvel Comics. I was doing rock and roll writing. The story that preceded this was I spent 48 hours with the Stones when they came. They were the first group to do two nights at the Spectrum in Philadelphia. That was a big deal at the time.
And you were a kid. I mean, you're talking to the Moody Blues.
Yeah, 20s,
and, yeah. Bruce Springsteen, those kinds of folks. And then you end up in
1976.
You decide, though, that you want this job at Rodale Press, which is in your neighborhood.
Well, what happened is in 1976, I was a writer for the Inquirer Sunday magazine, the Philadelphia Inquirer being the paper of merit in Philadelphia, and was working at MMR, the rock and roll station in town. And I was driving in on a rainy day and hydroplaned and got hit by a car and almost died. And after like 10 hours of surgery, the doctor slaps me around and goes, okay, we saved your life for now, but the odds are that you're going to get shock lung. And most people don't survive that. He told me afterwards when I reported the story, I said, I can't die. This is too good a story. After that, I got hired by the Temple Alumni Review magazine to write medical stories for them because I had done so well off the bat. And then when I decided that I wanted to stop doing all this freelancing, all this crazy running around, and I never really enjoyed the rock and roll, believe it or not.
Wow.
It wasn't about anything. And I had seen too many people who were like 20 years older than me who were still doing the same thing. And I thought that I understood some things that were happening in the world of health and nutrition that could actually help people. So I got a day job at Rodale Press. Meanwhile, I had met this wonderful, beautiful woman who wanted somebody to grow raspberries for her.
And so you obliged.
Exactly, sure. Raspberries are easy. But I was very well known. I mean, for my 17 years at Rodale, I was a health writer for the first 10 years. I was very happy. I was became editor of different health newsletters. I was the editor of
Men's Health, right.
Before it became a magazine. But organic gardening had fallen into a kind of a trough where they weren't about gardening anymore. They were doing features on Meryl Streep and humpback whales on the cover. And I had an organic garden, which didn't get enough sun, and I was figuring out how to do all these things, and there was no venue for people like me. So when the editor was let go, I went to the president of the company and said, this is my job. And here is a man who is just brilliant, and the first time I ever heard him stutter. He said, no, you'll be the editor of prevention someday, but what do you know about organic gardening? And luckily, it was the middle of summer. So the next day, I bring in a pint of raspberries, these beautiful, sweet bell peppers that were called lipstick, just absolutely gorgeous, an ear of platinum lady sweet corn, which had a purple husk covering the ears.
So this was sort of your resume for
this job. Yeah, I said, this is my resume, you know.
And it got you the job.
Yeah.
So you're doing this job, and at the same time, you're being called by the local WHYY to come in for one of their programs, Radio Times
in the morning,
to be the gardening expert.
Yeah.
So how does this lead you to
the gardening expert Saturday mornings on the Today Show
for WTOP in Washington, the all news radio station?
Yes, but for me to have gone to school for radio, TV, film to get a regular gig on the Today Show, that was like winning the Olympics every month.
So tell us, how do you prepare for an episode of You Bet Your Garden?
I show up. You know, it's the best radio is humans having a conversation. How did we prepare for this? We didn't.
You just walked into the studio.
You walked into the studio. It's like you're at a party or you're at a dinner where you don't know anybody. And so you strike up a conversation. And one of the problems I have with, quote, writers is people who are trying to learn, they write. They sit down and they write. And you know what happens? It's awful. It's overly structured. There's no humanity in it. One of the gifts I always had, despite being dyslexic, or perhaps because I'm dyslexic, is I couldn't write. But I could tell a story.
But you
I
had
could
a career
talk.
In writing. That really baffles the mind.
No. When I was the editor of Allergy Relief Newsletter for Rodale, 3 years, it was a wonderful job. I loved it. One of the things I covered was an inhaler company, a company that made inhalers for asthmatics, gave this award every year, Asthma Athletes. These were high school kids who had excelled at athletics so much that they were given college scholarships, who had severe asthma. And every year this company would throw a banquet in their honor. And the first time I interviewed them, I said, you're gasping for breath all the time, and yet you chose to be a runner. Why?
Interesting.
And one after the other would say, because it's what we were told we couldn't do, or what we felt we couldn't do.
And so, were you told in high school that you were never going to be a good writer?
No. Actually, from grade school through high school, I was told that I was a very good writer. But I couldn't spell, and nobody could understand why they enjoyed my writing so much, because it was all kind of backwards than what they were used to. But I had done what a good editor would always do. I would write something out, and then because I knew I had some sort of disability, I would let it sit, and then I would start to reverse the words and reverse the paragraphs. Every writer buries their lead. You sit down and write a story the first time, the third paragraph is the one you should open with. The only difference between a good writer and a bad writer is a bad writer turns in that first draft. And the best writing to me is like this. It's somebody talking to you. It's not someone deliberately writing.
Now, you've sort of been compared to the click and clack of organic gardening. And of course, that program is infused with humor. And of course, so is You Bet Your Garden. Is that something that you don't plan that as well either? That just happens spontaneously
conversations? I had to fight. When I first got my radio show, it was simply local in Philadelphia for a few years while we worked out the bugs. For the first 3 months, every time I would come out of the studio at noon on a Saturday after having done the show, my producer would put his arm around me and go, Mike, you got to stop being funny, man. It's a gardening show. It's not some sort of humor hour. And I would go, if this is a gardening show and there's no humor, it's going to close on Saturday night, you know.
The interesting thing about gardening shows, and what I've read is what makes them so popular, is that it's all of these people coming together to hear other people talk about their gardening failures.
Yes, yes. Garrison Keillor once said, the worst conversation you can have is with someone who has a wonderful life. They're talking about how their children are all doctors and they just found this fabulous Chardonnay from France for $4 a bottle. You just want to kill them. Now, the guy with no eyebrows and the bandages on his nose who tried to start his car battery with another car battery held onto the terminals upside down, he's got a story for you. He's somebody you want to talk to.
Well, I want to hear your story because you are the son of a Philadelphia homicide detective.
And a mother who worked in mob joints on the weekends to make money for the family. Seriously, Ozzie and Harriet. My dad was a homicide detective for the Philadelphia police. My mother worked as a cocktail waitress in mob joints on the weekends to bring in extra money.
You weren't kidding.
No. She actually had to change job once when my father made homicide. And I'll tell you the two names of the restaurants. She worked at Scioli's and she worked at the Southwark Club, Which one did she have to leave? The Southwark Club. She went to Scioli's because there was less risk of a murder happening there than there was at the Southwark Club.
So my guess is in Philadelphia, you were not gardening. Gardening was not...
No, the only gardener on our block was Bobby Schaefer's father, who was an exterminator. And he grew tomatoes in the front yard every year.
Speaking of tomatoes, that is probably the most written about topic in gardening magazines. And you've probably written or edited your fair share of tomato stories.
My tomato book is in its fourth printing with its third publisher.
And I think the title gets a little bit longer every time you come out with a new edition. What is it about homegrown tomatoes?
Supermarket tomatoes put my kids through college. They pay my mortgage. They bought my cars because they taste so poor that people are driven to try and grow their own. And they think tomatoes are easy because everybody grows them. But actually, they're one of the hardest edible crops to grow because they're these huge, rangy, unruly vines. And people refuse to accept that. So they're trapped into buying my book and needing my advice because they desperately want to recapture that taste they had maybe 20, 30 years ago on a summer day at a farm or at their grandparents' house where they bit into a warm tomato out in the field and they got that perfect mix of sugars and acids with all those back notes, one of those big beefsteaks that takes 90, 100 days to ripen up.
And you call them the gateway drug to gardening.
Yeah, because once you get good at growing tomatoes, everything else is easy. You start, you're just going to grow a couple of tomato plants. Before you know it, you got canna lilies, you got tuberose, you got 1,800 hot pepper plants. You know, you're growing your own potatoes. By the way, potatoes are totally underrated. If you have never grown a potato, you've never tasted a potato. Because a potato dug fresh from the ground, put it in a bucket of water, and bite into it.
Juice, like an apple.
Juice will run down your face as if it was a tomato or an apple.
That potato story has me wondering about where organic gardening is going. You know, you've got critics on one side saying the problem with organic gardening is you could never naturally come up with all of the nitrogen that you need to feed the world.
Right. There aren't enough humans peeing. The main nitrogen fertilizer used by commercial chemical gardeners and farmers is urea. It's fake pee. Now, if we ever run out of the real thing, sure, but I think there's more than enough, don't you? No. In 1991, the National Academy of Sciences commissioned a large-scale study of organic farming, comparing it to conventional farming. The conclusions they came to satisfied no one, which meant they're true. And it was that organic farming and conventional farming, if done correctly, produce exactly the same amount of food on exactly the same amount of land for exactly the same cost. The difference is conventional farming puts all the money into chemicals, and organic farming puts all the money into hand labor because you need people to be looking at things, to checking things.
So if that's the case, why do we continually hear that if we were to switch from conventional farming to organic farming, we would need twice the land and that you would only be getting 50% of the yield?
Well, that's because the people who run chemical companies that supply all these agribusinesses have $1 billion a year to spend on PR. And they have bought white coats. They have bought scientists just hands down. I've debated them at conferences. I've debunked studies. There was one study that claimed that it would cost like $400 to grow the wheat for a loaf of bread if you followed all the organic methods. But I went to college on a science scholarship. I can read studies. I've read complex medical studies. When I called for the raw study, this was a guy who worked for a university, and he outlined this was going to be my study. I was going to interview organic farmers and conventional farmers, and he got the grant money. And then as soon as he gets the grant money, he goes, oh, I'm out of time. I can't do this. So he asks people in chemical companies to extrapolate what it would cost for the organic methods. And that's where they came up with that. There is no real data that shows any difference. We can feed the world organically. The only difference is some companies won't make as much money, but on my side, more people will be employed in jobs in the outdoors, not being exposed to toxic chemicals and giving the food a face.
In 2002, the Nobel Prize-winning plant breeder Norman Borlaug said, "We aren't going to feed 6 billion people with organic fertilizer. If we tried to do it, we would level most of our forest, and many of those lands would be productive only for a short period of time." How do you respond to that?
That's why you got the Nobel Prize. You don't get it rolling out of bed in the morning. No, it's more and more. As you know, organics is the only portion of the food economy that continues to grow. What I find more interesting, the debates that you're citing, I mean, I think they were over in the 90s, quite honestly. The big debate right now is, how do people feel about very large-scale companies growing food organically versus the local farmer, the small-scale farmer?
Right, because the idea seems to be that small is better.
Well, you know,
whether that's true or not.
This was a quandary. I mean, because one of the things people told me when I was the editor of Organic Gardening, if I succeed and organic becomes the norm, some small-scale gardeners will be priced out. And as you probably know, the largest supplier of organic food in the world to retailers is Walmart.
Right.
But is that a bad thing, that now a young mother overwhelmed and overworked can go into the Walmart
and can afford it for the first time?
And can get organic milk and butter and eggs and chicken and all these top of the food chain things that are so important. And yet those same people on the weekends, they're going to be the first one at the local farmer's market. They're going to be the first one to buy into a share of the CSA. So I got a big tent. I want everybody in there.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is organic gardening guru Mike McGrath. His popular gardening show, You Bet Your Garden, combines expert gardening advice with a sense of humor. The show airs on 50 stations in 23 states and Canada.
And the Virgin Islands.
And the Virgin Islands.
We're hot in the Virgin Islands. I keep saying I have to go down and inspect these stations to make sure they're safe. And the only time I'm free is in January.
They're not falling for that. That's right.
Nobody.
So I'm kind of curious about the title, You Bet Your Garden. Where'd that title come from?
Okay, so when I would be stopped at a stoplight back in the 80s, and I would have an idea, I would have a little scratch pad and a pen, and I would write down the idea, and I would put it in the glove compartment. And then finally, when I had worn one of our Subarus to the ground and traded it in, you have to clean it out. Well, my glove compartment would fill four shopping bags, and then sorting through all this stuff, I found lots of ideas, names that I couldn't. It was like when you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning. Oh, this is the greatest idea ever. And you look in the morning and it says, gabba-shabba. But I had written down, You Bet Your Garden, independently over a period of 2 years, like five times.
Interesting.
And of course, it's a play on You Bet Your Life. But I also thought it would tell people right away it's about gardening. Garden is the noun. But the You Bet Your would imply Groucho Marx and humor and fun and conversation. I also thought it was a totally honest title, because that's what you do if you buy into my advice, You Bet Your Garden. And all the people at public radio on the first day, my absolute first day on the air, said, "We have a different name for the show, Mike. Dig It. What do you think about Dig It?"
And what did you think?
And, well, it was 2 minutes to 11. We're going to go on the air live at 11, and my hand is literally on the door to go into the studio. And I looked at them and I just let the door go.
You weren't going in with that title.
Okay, You Bet Your Garden. It's fine.
You know, you say that composting is the only way to be a good gardener. And that most of us get it wrong, that we don't create compost with the right ingredients. Just don't do it right.
Do you remember the first time you tried to make a Thanksgiving turkey?
I do, because there was a bag inside of it.
Yeah, exactly. There's this old Furry Freak Brothers strip that one of the guys makes a turkey for Thanksgiving, and somebody coming as a guest goes, "Did you stuff it?" He goes, "You know, I didn't have to. It wasn't empty." Nobody gets anything right the first couple of times. The only way we learn is by failure. A man who succeeds at everything in his life dies as ignorant as the day he was born. But failure is intensely good for your brain cells. Failure tells you, no, don't do that again. You barely got that toe straightened out afterward. So You're going to mess up. It's okay. It's not like getting into a car accident. So you killed a couple of tomatoes. You know not to do that bad thing again. You put wood ashes into your compost and everything shut down. Or you just piled up garbage and, if you're lucky, robber flies and not regular fly larvae in the compost. Okay, so you learn not to do that again. The only bad result of failure would be you thinking that it can't be done. You're just not giving yourself enough time to learn it. My first 5 years of gardening, especially something like seed starting, which is a totally different skill than gardening. I mean, it was pitiful. Literally, the Red Cross was coming by to my transplants with blankets and chocolate and a lawyer. But then year 8 or 9, I'm not even thinking about what I'm doing. And I'm growing plants for everybody in the neighborhood.
And actually, you've simplified for home growers through your The Kitchen Garden Box how they can save seeds every year.
You don't have to. If you're not good at seed starting, buy your plants in a garden center. What if they're not organic? Don't worry about it. Grow them organically. It's what you do in your landscape that counts. You tried composting for 5 years, you're a miserable failure, you don't have enough fall leaves, well, go out and buy bulk compost. Or maybe your municipality makes compost that you can get for free or for a low price. Don't worry about it. Don't stress it. Gardening has to be fun.
And are you still having fun?
Yeah. It has to be fun or you wouldn't do it the next year.
What are some of the biggest mistakes that people are making right now, especially since it's just so wet out there?
Anything they do with wet soil is going to be tragic. In our region here in State College, trying to sow a cool season lawn, fescue or bluegrass, anytime in the spring is going to be a miserable failure. The soil is much too cold. Grass seed takes 70 degree soil temperature to germinate. That's 4 inches down. You know how long it takes to get 70 degrees, 4 inches down in your soil in State College? And these grasses are from the United Kingdom. They don't know our summers. But if you plant in August, which is totally counterintuitive to the American mind, the soil is brilliantly warm. The grass seed.
But you have to water it so much.
Pardon?
In August, you probably have to
do
more watering.
No, the fall rains are right around the corner. And the grass seed sprouts. The days are getting shorter. The nights are getting cooler. That's the DNA of these lawn grasses. So they go through the fall. They love it. They go through the winter. That's fine. They go through the spring, which is beautiful. By the time they get to the heat of summer, which stresses cool season lawns, they're almost a year old.
You say the secret to a good lawn is cutting it no shorter than 3 inches, which a lot of people, they're thinking at 3 inches, that's when it needs to be mowed.
No, 4 inches is when it needs to be mowed and you take off 1 inch. But see, American guys are smart. If I cut the lawn shorter, I won't have to mow it as often. Excuse me, if you don't want to mow it so often, why do you have an $8,000 lawn tractor with headlights and a satellite? No, I don't want to mow it that often. So I'll cut it really short. Well, if you cut a cool season lawn below 3 inches, it goes into a panic state. It doesn't have enough solar panels on top to fuel the growth of the roots. So rather than grow slowly, it grows in a panic state really fast, using up any nutrients, sending up these little radio tower shoots all through the lawn. So the guy who scalps his lawn on Sunday, looks out on Wednesday, goes, oh, wow, the lawn looks really ratty. I should cut it again. Maybe I should cut it shorter this time. And this is the guy you see with the dirt blowing out the back of the lawnmower. And he wonders why he's got the bare spots. When you let a lawn achieve 3 inches, it grows at its slowest possible rate because plants are as lazy as we are. It does not need a greater height. It has all the solar energy collecting blades it needs. So it grows more slowly up top. More importantly, it now devotes half of its strength to root growth underground. A lawn that's cut at 1 to 2 inches might have roots that go down as far as a foot. But a lawn that's cut at 3 inches will have roots that easily go down 4 feet.
And, of course, inadequate watering is going to cause the same short roots.
Actually, not inadequate, frequent watering. If you water your lawn every day, it's always moist at the root zone. Why would the roots go to work? They don't have to. You soak your lawn, if you don't get rain, once a week deeply, an inch of water, which is a lot of water. Then that moisture will slowly recede in the soil till it gets down to the root zone, and then the roots will take over and follow the water, and root hairs will grow and develop. The lawn won't fall over with X's over its eyes. The roots will grow deeper following the water down. Then at the end of a week, you give it a deep watering again. And none of this, by the way, is intuitive, which is why what I bring to the table has some value for people, to explain to them that not everything gets planted in the spring. And you don't mow less often by, you know, cutting down to bare dirt.
Well, a lot of people right now are thinking about this unseasonably warm winter.
Nothing we can do about it. That's why you got the expression, lose the farm. If we have more of this climate change, more dramatic climate change, the two warmest winters in history, back to back, followed by cold snaps at the end, you're going to see a lot of damage to not only home gardens, people may never see certain shrubs bloom again, but you're going to see a tremendous amount of damage to commercial horticulture. Last year, throughout Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, the whole mid-Atlantic region, a good third of the fruit orchards were devastated. Crops, early blooming crops like peaches and apples that were in full bloom a month ahead of time, and then a normal winter day came in and killed the flowers. Well, that's all she wrote.
Right, and according to a climate scientist, spring is happening 2.5 days earlier every decade.
Yeah, and the plants that adapt best to that are the plants that other people are calling invasive invaders, not the ones that we've grown for centuries under different conditions, under winters that were much more normal, summers that were much more normal, with not as many paved surfaces on the planet.
Speaking of invasives, are there particular insects or plants, invasives, that you're most concerned about?
What I would try to tell people is don't plant things like running bamboo or in warmer regions, Bermuda grass that are going to get out of control unless you know what you're doing. Now, things like Japanese honeysuckle and porcelain berry vine that are spread by birds love this climatology. They're going to succeed. But I think people fail to understand that nature was never static. Nature is always changing. Nature is always getting rid of what she considers to be loser plants, and the stronger plants are taking over. And you can fight them all you want, but you're fighting nature. And the late Bob Rodale, who I worked with at Rodale Press right before I became editor of Organic Gardening magazine, used to say that people just forget that nature bats last. And you can run up the score as much as you want, but eventually you're going to sit down and nature's going to fight back, and she's got more energy and hits in her than you do.
If you can get listeners right now to adopt one new practice this growing season, what would you tell them to do?
Don't buy any fertilizers, pesticides, or herbicides. Trust your plants, protect your pollinators, protect your birds. If you are a, quote, conventional gardener using Miracle-Gro and Roundup, fungicides, just stop. You'll see toads. You'll see birds. You'll hear bird calls all morning long and all evening long. You'll see pollinators. There's maybe 200, 250 different kind of native bees here that you'll never see if you're out spraying constantly.
All right, good tip. Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
That was the fabulous Mike McGrath, host of WHYY's You Bet Your Garden, which airs here Sunday mornings at 11. To hear more of this interview, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia. Thanks for joining us.